It's Thursday, February 24th, 2011, and you're listening to episode 222 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 11 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Chad.
This is Wayne.
My name is Pat.
My name is Jeff.
I'd like to welcome back Jeff again for the second show, which we said was going to occur within the course of about an hour. And actually, because we keep jacking around, double headers dragging on all night.
Hey, man, I'm really happy. I just introduced a bunch of people to CeeLo Green. I'm a huge CeeLo Green fan, and I love sharing good music.
You know, I was familiar with him as Gnarls Barkley. I'd never heard him under that name. You sort of introduced me to him.
Yes.
But nonetheless, I'd like to welcome Jeff back from our Sunday gaming group and also from his podcast, Gaming Asylum, which
at angelfire.com/Libsyn.
On MySpace.
On MySpace.
Michael, let's get an address down.
Good heavens, if you guys are that far off, I don't know. Send me an email. I mean, if you just need a WordPress install, I'll put one on my server for you.
There
Goodness gracious.
There is a website out there. He's actually written a blog or two for it. There's a thread in the shameless plug section that has the information. It's just not anything that rolls off the tip of my tongue. It's not Gaming Asylum, for one thing.
Well, all right. Several years ago, I was speaking along with some of these other guys at a convention on podcasting. Well, the convention was on podcasting, but we were speaking on podcasting. And someone was asking for advice on setting up a podcast domain name. And I said, there's really three things you have to accomplish. One, it has to be not taken already, which in this day and age is a feat.
Website, yeah.
Number two, it has to be memorable. And number three, it has to be easy to spell. And this became a point of comedy when a woman there who was a writer who was looking into podcasting's way of promoting her writing could not recall her own domain name. And apparently we're now seeing a reverb of that. So
the other big piece
it may
of
be
advice,
time not to GeoCity so much as GoDaddy.
Yeah.
The other big piece of advice I always hear out there is your podcast and your website should say something about what it is you do. You should be able to hear the name and know what it is. So, of course, that's why it's Fear the Boot. Everyone knows what that means.
Oh, yeah, totally. Absolutely. That completely encompasses our entire market strategy, technology positioning synergy.
Did I ever tell you that I absolutely cannot stand the name Fear the Boot? I absolutely hate it.
You know what?
But
did I ever tell you I don't give a
argue with it, though.
Yeah,
I can't argue with it because it works.
Yeah, it's
people have come. It's everything you said. It's not taken. It's original. It rolls off the tongue. People remember. People have told us. I started listening to Fear the Boot because I saw a listing of it, and I'm like, Fear the Boot? What the hell is this? I gotta listen to this crap, and then they ended up liking it.
It's a powerful identity.
You're a marketing genius, Dan.
Meanwhile, I hate to say it, but I believe the potential still exists for someone to be the first reviewer of Gaming Asylum on iTunes.
Oh. No, seriously, though, you guys...
see if I can correct
so
that.
Your show is about board gaming. Is that correct?
Actually, that's the one thing it's not about. It's role-playing games.
Long-time listener, first-time commenter.
Yeah.
Long-time commenter, first-time listener.
It's about face-to-face board games and video games.
Okay. So it has nothing to do with board gaming, exactly like I said. Okay.
How many episodes do you have? Please don't say 300.
We have three out there on iTunes and two more that are in the editing process.
Okay, so
it's a new podcast.
Yeah, it's
okay.
Still,
yeah. But still, I got much love, even if I'm...
You care a whole lot, too. We can tell.
I got much love for Jeff. I got much love for Asylum Runner, for DT Defender. So I will definitely put a link to this in the show notes. If you are all interested in not board gaming, then be sure to check out their podcast. It's just, you know what? It's just, and this brings us actually to the top we're talking about today. I only have one announcement. Yeah, exactly.
You know, I was actually shocked when you said he had a podcast. I had no idea. So you're more informed than I am.
So I just presumed, because today we're going to talk about board gaming. Now, the reason we're going to talk about board gaming, outside of the fact that it's a good subject to talk about, is the fact that of all the people I associate with, Jeff is a freaking walking encyclopedia of board games. He doesn't know about role-playing games before. Right. And so when Jeff's on a podcast, I just presumed it's got to be about board games.
I'm a gourmand. I do all sorts of games that are legal to play in a room with strangers.
I have to say that I know a lot of people personally and sort of, you know, through the internet, not right. ever met them, who know a lot about board games. And when I went to purchase a board game, I contacted Jeff. I'm like, Jeff, is this a really good board game? It was Republic of Rome. Or what?
It was Tribune.
Tribune.
It was on sale, yes. And I said yes.
We played it once, and it was a really good game.
This would be like, Ronald McDonald has a podcast. Oh, it must be about hamburgers. No, it's about the Han Dynasty. Why would you think?
Really? Wait, does that one have a website I can go to?
RonaldMcDonald.HanDynasty.MySpace.GeoCities/Angelfire.
I'm there.
Co-host the Han Burglar.
I like it.
That just stole the show.
I can't make any counter puns without being really racist, so I'll just sit here.
I have a
new
character name for a while. I want to make a thief now. Make a rogue.
The Han Burglar. He runs around stealing Chinese dynasties.
I also pickpockets people named Solo.
Wow. Okay. So.
You should have stopped where you were ahead.
Damn it.
For some reason, all I can picture now is Mayor McCheese hosting the rest of the show, and I don't even know why that's a compelling mental image, but that's where I'm stuck. We're looking at kicking off a charity auction to help support Raina's Wings this year. We decided to approach it a little bit differently, and we wanted to put together some items that were, I don't know, comedic, sentimental, I have no idea what. How this idea
Dan.
Sort of...
Are you going to put up Unicron?
Well, we're going to have to see. Because see, how this idea sort of came into my mind was in a planning thread for Fear the Con. Stacy mentioned that she still has her Fear the Con 1 shirt with the train dirigible, and it's signed by Phil and all this stuff. And she's like, I'll auction this off. And I got to thinking, you know, I wonder if we were to do a charity auction, what would people even want us to put up as auction items? So I am opening this up. I'll start a thread on the forum, or you can post a comment in response to this blog post. I'd say send it to my email, but who are we kidding? And so if you have an idea of something you would love to bid on, whether it's something we've talked about on the show, something we've never even mentioned, but you would just love to see. I have no idea what this even would be. The only thing I won't put out there is anything we've been given as a gift, because I think it'd be kind of rude. But anything else that you can come up with, post out there, because I would love to have some fun with this, but I don't even know what people would be interested in actually bidding on. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're thinking about. Take a little bit of time, think about it, and get back to us either on the forums or on a blog comment in response to this episode. And we'll aggregate that and see what we can come up with here moving forward.
I think one of the things we should auction is a date with Wayne. If you can make it into St. Louis.
I don't think my wife would care for that too much.
What if
it's
a man?
Tell her it's for charity.
Yeah, and we can also make them have to pass the questionnaire first.
That's right. That's right.
That is true. I wish I still had that. If so I had the we. File, I would put that up for auction to see if anyone would want it.
Or we could maybe get one of the Chris Hussey Battletech love letters, maybe the Net Positive Cyborg. I mean, there's all kinds of possibilities.
We cannot
here.
Give away a love letter from his wife. We cannot give that away.
I don't know.
You're pretty free with Chris's love letters.
They're awful. I mean, Julie's probably doesn't have the heart to tell him this, but she'd probably be glad to get rid of him.
I'm still wondering if you'd be willing to put up Rift's Ultimate Edition as the jewel of the sale.
Ooh,
you know, I do have Rift's Ultimate Edition, and it's signed by the designers.
Yeah, what's this is not the Ultimate Edition, but look what I got right here. I got a Rift's rule book. We could sign it, take a dump on it.
I'm serious. I have a hardcover Rift's Ultimate Edition signed by the designers.
I'm terribly
which was given to you.
Which was given to me as a gift. And I am, well, it was given to me as a gift. And I think he said that if I find someone worthy, I can re-gift it to someone.
Okay.
Else.
Well, see, that's a little bit different.
Maybe.
I didn't want to be like
so worthy may have a dollar value.
Yes, worthy may be $1.
You know, I think Dan may still have my first ever character sheet.
I might. I'd have to look around. There's the die I got at the 2007 Gamma convention, the trade show convention that gave us Foolish Legitimacy. So I have no idea. But yeah, you guys
know. We do have a lot of crap.
Yeah, I love it. And it could be something completely different. Like, you want a mic signed by all of us with like a silver paint mark.
Dan,
I have no idea.
Would you mail someone the big board?
I don't even know how the hell I would ship the big board. I'd have to hire my neighbor who builds and delivers shuffle boards to move it for me. That thing's 4 foot by 6 foot. Doesn't exactly fit in an envelope.
You just haven't found a sufficiently big enough envelope.
Yeah, they got to put those big checks in some kind of an envelope. That's about that right size, isn't it?
That's true. I mean, yeah, the Russian mail order brides have to come in something, don't they?
That's true, too, yeah.
Oh, you said, did you say big checks? I said big chicks.
I said big checks.
Oh,
but he'll gladly but change. Yeah, it
I'll
to
take checks. Some. I'll take right. Checks as in, you know, Czech Republic.
Czechoslovakian women.
Yes.
Yeah.
All righty. So the topic we're going to talk about today, which is why I have Jeff on this show, since apparently he doesn't talk about it on his own show, is his area of expertise, which is board games. Now, one of the things that Fear the Boot has always sort of modeled itself around is we're an intentionally abstracted show. And what I mean by that is while we may mention...
We are a D&D only podcast.
Exactly. We are a complete OGL D20.
Yes. Yeah.
While we may use specific games or titles for examples, we try to talk about ideas that you could apply to any game. I mean, certainly if we talk about like making a good character, yeah, the trappings may be different from game to game, or the rules may encourage or disallow certain things, but the general concepts of don't be an asshat and fit into a group template and finding balance and all that stuff, you can apply that to any game. Similarly, coming up with a good story, a lot of the concepts that you would use in Battletech, you can use in D&D, you can use in Dresden Files, you can use in whatever.
But you forgot about 500 games there. Someone's going to be offended.
I know. Someone will be offended that I failed to mention Mice in the Vineyards or Guard. But board games are different because of the fact that with a board game, what you have is the product. That the concepts that apply to one game very likely don't apply to another game. It is a completely different experience because unlike a role-playing game, which is, let's just say...
I'm sorry, I really want to play Mice in the Vineyard and Dog Guard now. I can't stop thinking about it now. Damn it.
It's like the Mayor McCheese image.
It is. Dogs in the Vineyard only use zoom down and it's mice. Keep going. I'm trying to get out of this.
Is you have a mechanical experience. I mean, with a role-playing game, you have some percentage mechanical, some percentage storytelling and characters and all stuff. But with a board game, it's 90-some-odd percent mechanics. I mean, certainly there's attitude and etiquette you bring to the table, but there's not 100,000 different ways to play Age of Steam. I mean, you know, yeah, there's some house rule and stuff, but you get my point. So I wanted to bring Jeff on because, as I said before, this man knows an enormous amount about board games. He knows about titles I've never even heard of before. And so I felt he could help us talk much more authoritatively about the subject. The first thing I want to talk about is sort of a preliminary idea that Chad threw out and doesn't remember. I'll go ahead and say that for you.
I was searching my mind. I'm still mired in Mice in the Vineyard, though. Damn it.
was the fact that for whatever strange reason, RPG and board game culture, despite occupying the same space and having their products sold in the same store, don't seem to overlap as deeply as you might expect.
Right.
I know a lot of board gamers who don't touch role-playing games, and I know a lot of role players, myself included, who through either much or all of their role-playing career never really touched board games. And by board games here, we're talking about stuff like the Euro-style games, Mayfair, Fantasy Flight, whatever, Days of Wonder. We're not talking about Milton Bradley and Parker Brothers.
Yeah, we're not talking about Monopoly.
Right. Let's start with that. Why do you guys...
Mikey Mason somewhere is screaming at the mics for you guys every time you say we're not talking about
Actually,
Monopoly.
Actually, I'm a Monopoly defender as long as you play it by the rules.
And I've heard that before. I've heard that Monopoly is long and boring and painful to play because people use the house rules. The rules, as written, my understanding, I've never played it like this, but the rules as written, it's supposed to be an actually really fun game.
And the house rules have been pervasive enough that they've even made it into video game versions.
Yeah, Monopoly became an oral tradition somewhere in the 50s and 60s, where people who had bought it in the 30s were teaching it to their children, and the children never looked at the rule book because they were learning it from their parents. And then that happened a generation, and then again, by that time, some of the house rules they put in that the people who read the rule books put in and said, we're going to change it like that. The people down the road said, we don't know that.
Right.
We just know what we know, and that's why there's money on free parking. Mm-hmm. Which will add an hour and a half to the game.
Why do you guys think that is? Why is there such a weak overlap between the board game and RPG communities? I mean, it's not a non-existent overlap, but it's not a deep one.
Part of me thinks, well, why should there be an overlap? I mean, it's two totally different kind of games. We should be playing each other's games because we're both geeks. But I'm not the only one who sees that. I mean, when you go to Gen Con, board gaming is a huge sponsor of Gen Con. In fact, this coming Gen Con, they're going to be an even bigger sponsor.
Yeah, and when you look at our forums, the board game threads are almost as big as the role-playing game threads.
When you go into,
I mean, I see a huge overlap. It's just within our own group here, we didn't have a lot of it.
It's actually changing a little bit. But when you go into your local gaming shop, you go there to get role-playing games. And it's also where people go to get board games, too. You can get them elsewhere now, but it used to be to get those Euro-style games, that was the only place you can go to get them.
It almost seems like they're the chocolate and peanut butter of the gaming world, because case in point, say about a year ago, I happened to stumble upon a gaming club at work, where I work, and I'm like, oh my God, this is awesome. So I actually was talking to a guy that's in it. I'm like, oh, what do you guys play? What games do you play? He starts rattling off all the games, you know, the typical board games, Catan, all these other board game kind of things. I go, oh, do you guys do any role playing? He goes, what?
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, oh, okay. It's that kind of a gaming club. Then I looked up their listing and saw they have like multiple events. They have like two events a month. There's 24 different things that they do in a year. And not a one of them has anything to do with role-playing. It's all board games.
Let me give you the shorthand here. If you're in a role-playing group and you want to find the person in that group who's most likely to play board games with you, look for the min-maxer. Board games are about wrapping your mind around a structure. And they're very much finding the niches, finding the strategy that works. Role-playing games, when properly played, are about story, character. Are about story and character, very loose, creative concepts. And so I have, when I was living in Illinois, I had a couple of players who were playing the role-playing games I was running, but they approached it like a board game. And you get very crunchy, very hard set dynamics, which I actually unintentionally brought into the first couple of sessions here. So I think the board gaming dynamic expresses the need for structure, the need for I can defeat this idea set, I can translate it into a successful strategy. Whereas the role-playing impetus is much more about I want to read this book, I want to tell this story, I want to be a part of the story. And that's why they generally don't mix very well.
Yeah. I think that you get people on the fringes of both of these cultures who really cross over a lot. I think I'm one of these people who crosses over the lot because I love board games and I love the crunch and the system and the structure of a board game.
And I would mix role-playing in with it.
I don't want there to be crunch like that level in my role-playing games. But I do put role-playing into board games, or at least the...
I find the board games I like the most are the ones where I can apply some kind of role-playing. That's why I love Arkham Horror so much, because of the fact that it's a cooperative game, just like most role-playing games. You have a character, just like a role-playing game, and if you start to tie together the character backgrounds with the event cards, and you really want to, it's not too hard to come up with an emergent story, just like a role-playing game.
Right.
And so I see that, I mean, I definitely have a preference that pushes me into certain board games, but keeps me out of other ones.
Dan, Jeff is far too polite to interrupt you. So.
I try. if you're a role-playing group looking to get into board games, there are generally three focuses of a board game. I would refer to them maybe as the three Ps. Planning, perchance, which is your luck-based games, and politics. Diplomacy is the old ancient champion, and we're going to have a game where everyone just talks to each other in small groups for 4 or 5 hours. There's another game that came out in the mid-90s. It's out of print now, but it's called Castle of Magic. All the players had individual objectives on how they conduct this ritual, whether or not there's a monster that goes free and eats people. But it actually had...
Do you have this game?
Used to.
Oh, I want to play. That sounds really cool.
I've heard of it, but I've never played it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. There were several times in college where I needed pizza, and I was there with the pizza, and that how my game collection shrank during college.
Gotcha.
But it's one of the few games I've ever seen that came with a talk chip that says every player has this chip they can turn in to say, we're all going to talk for 5 minutes and go off into private meetings and stuff like that. So there are games out there that kind of grow closer to the role-playing experience in terms of getting into what this position requires situationally and politically.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I've played something across every range, and I think the best games are some that blend a couple of those. Like, I love where chance and strategy meet head-on, and you have both aspects in the same game. That's where I get really excited.
Yeah, usually for your Grognard, your very, very in-depth board game lovers, they're going to want only a touch of luck, like a beginning setup.
Oh, yeah, I've definitely seen that.
Yeah, you'll find that a lot, because I think if you find a game that has no luck whatsoever, and there's more out there than just chess in that department, by the way, it tends to be very hard to recover from an early game setback. These become three-hour marathon marches to watch the player who was in first place at, you know, 5 minutes in win, because there's no real hiccup for him to encounter. If he implements his strategy perfectly, he won't miss.
Yeah, one of the ones that's thrown me off when I've been, you know, listening to a couple other podcasts or talking to people are there are a lot of people out there that get angry if they have to roll to move. My character in this board game should have stats that determine how far I move. If I have to roll to move, that is a bad mechanic.
I guess it goes back to what Jeff was saying, though, that if the appeal for some segment of the board gaming community, and obviously we don't want to overly stereotype here, but if the appeal for some segment of the board gaming community is the ability to manipulate a structure, randomness and surprise would very heavily interfere with that. I mean, you couldn't map out a strategy. You couldn't set things up the way you want them if at any given moment a six-sided die is going to land on a one instead of a six and stop everything you were doing. I guess in a role-playing game, we accept that as part of the story. Mm-hmm. That's just part
of the
chaos of the universe.
Look at that and you interpret. We'll take D20, for example. In a D20 system, you either hit or you miss, or you hit with a critical. How many times do you roll a D20 in your average game where you hit, but you didn't get that critical, but the number was really high? And so when you describe it as it's a really good hit. Or if you roll it and you miss, but you only miss by a little bit, you describe, you know, it's like, oh, I whip out my sword and I go to slice you, and you rip their clothes and they just barely dodge out of the way. But, you know, that's fine having that randomness in there, because a role player can really work with that randomness. Whereas in a board game, it's affecting your mechanic. It's affecting your mechanical strategy. And
well, I guess the other big difference
I don't find it's a bad thing.
With a role playing game, you win by having a good game, by everyone enjoying themselves, by it being a good story. With a board game, you are playing to win. It could be everyone together playing to win.
I disagree,
because I was totally going to saddle onto that point. I'd been prepping it for a couple minutes. In a board game, if you fail test X, you're losing and your play experience degenerates. Mm-hmm. In a role-playing game, if you win at success test X, you've got good story.
Right.
If you fail at success test X, you've got good story.
Right.
You may even have better story.
Yeah. And so I think that's absolutely that in a board game, success and a calculated strategy for success hit the enjoyment factor a lot more than role-playing games, just because there's no loser's game.
Yeah. And I totally agree with that. But when I play, I don't play to win, because when I play board games 9 times out of 10, I'm not playing them with my buddies who I'm on an equal footing with. I'm playing them at a board game meetup group with these people who are board gamers, and they know the strategies. They're nice people. They're not trying to slit my throat, but they're there to win, and they're better at the games than I am. My goal is to not come in last. I feel that if I come in last on a game, I have lost the game. So if I don't come in last, I'm happy. If I win, I'm ecstatic.
First, the Lord keep you and praise you for that attitude. Second, I want to bridge this to a wider topic, which is if you're learning a game for the first time, and I can't stress this enough, if you come into the game for the first time, your object is to learn the rules.
Yes.
If you feel that your enjoyment of the game is going to be dependent on winning that game, you're in for a world of hurt. And I've seen a lot of people walk away from individual board games, blame the person introducing the game because they didn't feel they could apply all of their skills to the game because they didn't know it yet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you actually win on that game will be a game you love for life. Puerto Rico, winning that on the first time I ever played it, I went out and bought that game.
I have to say that it's difficult to get your human emotions in check when you win a game that you're just trying to learn for the first time, and you're amongst people who are really much better than you are, and they did not give up the victory. Suddenly, that game has gone from maybe a good game to, this is a great game. Yeah. I love this game, even though it's not necessarily that great of a game.
And by the way, if you've got a group of board gamers who have one person you're trying to introduce, say a friend of yours, the great thing to do in that situation...
Let them win.
Not quite.
Just don't clown them.
Yeah.
What you do is you have three gamers... and the neutral party, as it were, everyone influences that person by saying, you should do this, you should do this, mm-hmm. offer the new person these varying strategies. Yes, each one of them is designed to help the players offering the strategy, but then that makes the analysis by the new player a lot easier to go, these are the roads I can go down, and that's who they help. Right. Who will help me the most in return? That's a good way to learn a game.
Jeff, why are you into board games? Why do you like them? Because you own a lot of board games, and you love playing them.
All right. I'm going to take this opportunity to say I'm not the board gaming savant. I want to defend myself. I play video games. Right. I play role-playing games.
You loaned me Alan Wake. I appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you. In high school, I was playing card games with my German teacher every lunch hour for 4 years. I generally like being around a table with friends. Mm-hmm. There are some board games that grip me more than others, usually because of their story or because of the personal interaction between the players. For instance, one of my favorites is called Titan the Arena. It's been reprinted as Colossal Arena. And the reason I like it is because if you try to win that game on your own, you will lose. You will lose bad. If you manage to chain things so that the player to your right is interested in what you want and the player to the left is also interested, you can kind of tag team the other side of the board. And as long as you can play off your neighbors well, you'll win that game. So I play board games because I play almost any game that isn't a video game because I like sitting around a table having fun with my friends. I play video games because they're a much more engaging form of a book, in my opinion, or because they're pretty.
One of the questions that I'd really like to cover as we talk about this is deciding what to buy. And there's several angles I want to approach this from because... as someone who's interested in board games, but is not deeply educated in them, I'm struggling with, number one, trying to find out what's out there, because quite frankly, it's a whole lot of products. And number two, then trying to figure out which of the ones that are out there fit my needs. So let me start with just a really simple question and get your guys' insight on this. What is a good way just to get a sense of what's available? And we'll dig into the detail of examining the products in a minute, but let's just start with this. How do you get exposed to the products, to the options?
I'm going to go with an obvious one. Walk into the game store and talk to the owner. That actually was how I ended up getting Castle Ravenloft recently. I knew of the game because I listened to one of the other games in the Pulp Gamer Network, Myriad Games. They do some great reviews. So I already knew about the game. I was already excited about the game because it sounded interesting. But I went in there and I told them, this is the kind of game I'm interested in. What fits that? And we looked game after game after game, and I ended up not getting any of those. I got Ravenloft because what I wanted, actually my wife bought it for me. But he showed me about 10 games that fit the criteria I told him I was looking for. Out of those, I'd never heard of 5 of them. That is one good way to see what's out there, is just talk to a guy that's trying to sell it to you.
Tap into your local community of gamers, which I'll expand on that originally, because usually the guy who owns the game store plays the games.
Yeah, the guy who owns the game store in this case is the sponsor of the board game meetup group three of us here are a member of.
Yeah, for two reasons. A, they know a lot of games, and usually they know, based on some initial questions, what game you might like. And second of all, 9 times out of 10, they're the people you're going to be playing the games with, which is actually the caveat, which is if you are introduced to a board game that you like, be careful that you're not buying the game only to have it sit on your shelf because the other person keeps bringing it. You have to develop a sense of your community's board game library, and you can gauge whether or not to purchase based on how likely it is that your copy will come into play.
That's actually why I don't own a copy of Catan. I love Catan, but where we were all playing it, someone already owned it. Yeah. So if I bought it, I knew I'd never get to play my copy.
Your advice, Jeff, though, sounds very heavy to a person who is just totally coming into this fresh. The idea that you have to get a sense for the community and what the community plays, what the community doesn't play, where I don't know anything about role-playing games. I don't know anything about board games.
Okay. absolutely true, which I'll direct it to the next spot you should look at, BoardGameGeek.com.
Yes.
This is a wonderful site for someone who doesn't know about the large library of deep strategic games to go, I'm going to sort based on the rating, and then I'm going to sort based on some descriptions of some mechanics that sound interesting and come up with a candidate list. Yeah.
Start on their top 100. See what starts looking good to you. If something looks good to you, then you can drill into that listing. And then it says it's genre, it's mechanic type, how many people it seats, how long it takes to play. Each one of those items are something you can click on, and it will give you lists of other games that fall within that single category.
Okay, so places you can look include meetups, conventions. We didn't mention those, but check out the board game lending libraries or pickup games at conventions. BoardGameGeek.com. Find someone who knows a lot about board games and ask them. You guys brought up several specifics in there, which I want to develop here into their own points. And let's start off with what Chad was calling earlier prior to recording, the cost-benefit analysis, the CBA, of owning a game.
I run through that every time I buy a game.
Yeah,
this is
a typical board game off the shelf. I mean, can run anywhere from $50 to $100.
You can run anywhere from $5 to $200.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. These games can be costly. And so some of the things that we suggest looking at, Jeff, you mentioned looking at your community of gamers. If the group you hang out with, somebody already has that game, then maybe you ought to try for a different title, because what's really the point of having two copies of the exact same game?
But if you intersect with two different communities, like, for instance, I have friends here who play games and friends in Chicago play games, I can take games I like from here, buy them, because I know I'm going to see them again.
Mm-hmm. Very true.
Wayne and I also have a balancing thing, too.
It works pretty well, actually.
Yeah. Wayne buys lots of cheaper games. I buy a few of the more expensive games, because I like big, huge, intricate games with lots of bits.
Yeah, and our reasoning is, in my case, when I run through that cost-benefit analysis, for me to spend the money on a game, I have to know I'm going to get playtime out of it. So I know these shorter games, which do tend to be the cheaper ones, the card games, the Fluxes, the things like that, I know I can get a bunch of those and I'll be able to play them more often, because they are quicker games. I don't need to dedicate 2 or 3 hours to the game. So for me, I go for a lot of these smaller games to just fill up the library, because I know I'll get to play them.
Here's another great question, one that you're hitting right up against. Who will you play it with? If you're going to go out and buy a game, you need to, first of all, understand that you will have someone to play it with, because if it's just going to sit on a shelf, you wasted $50.
I've got a group of friends. I role play every week with them. I love hanging out with them, gaming with them. And I want to do board games. They're not interested.
Yeah.
Well, your game's going to sit on the shelf and gather dust.
That's one thing that I don't know if anyone else here gets as excited about as I do. When I'm looking at a game trying to do that cost-benefit analysis, one of the first things I look at, of course, is how many players it seats. If one of the numbers on there is one, I am excited. I have no problem playing a board game by myself, and I'll enjoy it. And that then jumps up the value, because I don't need anyone else to play it.
Well, or
if I can play it with two, my wife and I can both play it.
Yeah, that's the next one to go to. You've also mentioned you play a lot of these games with your wife. So you look for games that we play with two players. I go the other direction, because I've been trying to wean my family off of Parker Brothers and Milton Bradley and over to some more interesting games. I specifically look for games that seat large numbers of players, because at family gathering, while I have almost no extended family, my immediate family is pretty damn large. I look for games that will seat 6 people, at least, typically. When I got Catan, first freaking thing I got was a 6-player expansion, because that way we still have to put people on teams, but at least we can have more of a broad play experience. Another thing is, how often are you going to play it? If you're only going to honestly play this game once or twice, maybe it ain't worth $75. Maybe it is. That's just a call you got to make. You guys talked about looking at Board Game Geek and how it has all these different metrics for describing games. And I think some of them are fairly self-explanatory. Number of players, average length of play time. We'll presume no one's so stupid they don't know what that means. But what are some of these other options? For example, I hear a lot of talk about things like this one's worker placement versus area control. Can you guys try and demystify some of that lingo?
Trader mechanic.
Yeah. How someone from the outside looking in, if they look at Board Game Geek and see the little blurb that may be laden with all kinds of lingo and jargon, how someone from the outside looking in could understand that.
All right, let's start with worker placement. Worker placement basically means you have a limited number of tokens. You put those tokens in places, and that reserves game actions or game resources for you. And usually there's a priority to say, I have first choice, so I can pin down whatever resource I want, and then you can't have that, so you have to go somewhere else. So in that sense, it's kind of mapping what's going to be important to my strategy over the coming turns, where do I need to go immediately, and what's going to be more important to cut off someone who's directly competing with me. That's how I'd phrase worker placement.
To phrase this in a somewhat, I suppose, obtuse way, you have 10 people to work 20 jobs, and you have to figure out where you want to put them.
Absolutely. And
except the other players, you have 10 people to work 20 jobs. I have 10 people to work the same 20, and so does Chad.
Yeah.
So you have to not only figure out where to place them, you have to figure out when to place them.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good description, because I've always struggled with how do you exactly explain worker placement other than you have people, you put them places. It is one of my favorite genres.
Now let's go to another one, which is called role selection. The granddaddy for this one for modern gamers is Puerto Rico, but the older granddaddy is Cosmic Encounter, which has been reprinted several times, is currently available from Fantasy Flight, highly recommended with a group of at least four players. This means every player has the opportunity to take either once or more than once during the game a one-shot ability that is accessible only to that player. So you'll have to assess which of those abilities will help you. In Cosmic Encounter, you have a one-shot ability. You take this alien race. This alien race has a certain power that you can use to maximize. In Puerto Rico, every turn, you're selecting which role will help you during the game.
Because you'll see a lot of these descriptions. Sometimes you'll see both descriptions on the same game. I've seen a few games where they take both of these concepts and mesh them together. I mean, just because it's worker placement doesn't mean you don't also have the role choice.
Absolutely. The board game designers are bouncing ideas off each other, and you will absolutely see remixes and reflavors. And even sometimes the board game designer themselves will go, I want to approach this idea again, but with another twist on it. So, for instance, there's a card game called San Juan, which is role selection, very similar in flavor to the board game Puerto Rico. And then they went and made a much more engaging and complex version of it called Race for the Galaxy, which is actually so popular, it's gotten three expansions so far.
Keep going with some of the other lingo. I'm sure there's a lot of it.
But there is.
Let's hit, you know, just some of the top ones.
All right,
let's
I think go with war games are pretty self-explanatory.
War games are very self-explanatory. Area control. This is a style of game where there are areas mapped out, certain divided areas, and you have the ability to put money or chips or whatever in them, and then whoever has the most chips in an area will score more points, make more money whatsoever. So that becomes a game of competing with players, matching their interest. Do I want to commit all of my resources to area X to totally dominate it, or am I worth more spreading out?
Give us a couple examples of that. It's sounding familiar. I know I've played games that have this mechanic.
Chaos in the Old World?
Yes, it is area control, but it has a little bit more war gaminess to it, only because you can have a limited attempt to wipe out your opponent's influence in that area. Mm. The actual, and to me, surprising thing is, I believe the currently number one ranked game on BoardGameGeek is a game called Twilight Struggle, which is a simulation of Cold War politics. It's area control.
Played Twilight Struggle, and it is a wonderful game. Mm-hmm. It's very, very complex. It's very cool. There's a lot of intricacies to it, and it's history. Like, every single thing, it's the Cold War. It's Russia versus the NATO, basically.
And you have decks for early war, middle war, and late war. So the early war cards will be stuff like Revolution in Cuba, whereas the late war cards will be stuff like Margaret Thatcher.
They have the Iron Lady and Ronald Reagan you can play, whereas you have, like, Charles de Gaulle and stuff. And it's very, very neat. Very cool game.
And this is area control because each of the players, the Soviet Union, United States, is determining how much influence to exercise over a country, and not just...
It's not an invasion of a country. It's influence over a country.
And it's not just the matter of I'm winning in this country because I have more influence, but it's how much I'm beating you by will determine how much score you get off of that country when a particular scoring event resolves. Mm-hmm. And so that's a good example of area control when it's multiple places you can put things and you have to be ultimately responsive to your opponent in what they are doing absolutely determines what I'm doing and vice versa. It's actually kind of difficult in an area control game to come off with a overall strategy for the board game because you have to react.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas worker placement can actually get a little bit more into the non-interactive because you can say there are certain positions that will always be optimal. You can't say that with an area control, for instance.
Right.
Not often. Tile laying. Big example of this is Carcassonne, which is one of the more popular games to come out in recent years. Usually the player has either a selection of or one tile that they can put somewhere on the game board that they can determine advantage from. Like, this tile has a road, I'm going to use it to complete that road or to divert your road.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple of different types of games like this. Like the 1830, 1870 train games are very similar to this, where you've got track you're putting down to block your opponents. It mixes this with a rudimentary simulation of stock market, where you've got stock and train companies, mm-hmm. and they go up or down based on how well the train is performing on the ground. Train games actually is a big subset of the board game market, and there's two or three general types. There's the stock game, where you've got how well is this performing. There is Ticket to Ride, which mm-hmm. is just a very classically, very generally accessible game of, we're going to connect these cities to match the route cards I've got, which say connect Dallas to New right. Orleans for 10 points. And then there's the game, the genre is called Choo-choos and Crayons.
Choo-choos and Crayons.
If you've ever been to a game convention, you've seen the words Puffing Billy on the book somewhere. That's what this is about. It's a system of games where you have a map of a particular region. Let's say Empire Builder is going to be the one that most people are going to want to start with because it's the United States. The map is all just a series of dots laid out in this triangular pattern. Every player has a crayon.
Mm-hmm.
You draw your track on the map. And it costs you like $1 for a straight line, $2 to go into a mountains. You get cards that say, I get $20 for delivering uranium to Dallas. And this is actually a very lovely game for just relaxing with friends, because I've heard it effectively described as four-player solitaire. There's not a lot of ways you can interact with your opponent. It's what cards do you get, the luck factor, and how well can you manage those cards so that, for instance, you're not going across the board for one load, but you're going across the board to drop off two loads and pick up one for the trip back.
See, that's something that I need in a game, though. That's what really tweaks me for a game, is interaction with the people around me. That's what I want. I want to either trade cards with them, I want to look at them, I want to have to say something to them, or I want to have to do something on the board that affects them in some way. And all that reciprocates, too, back to me. I don't want to feel like I'm playing a game by myself in a room with a bunch of people.
And I'm with you. As someone who actually plays single-player games quite often, if I'm playing with other people, I want to know I'm playing with other people.
Right.
I want my game experience to be influenced by the people around me.
I always tell this story too about Dominion, the very, very popular customizable card game, where the first couple of times I played it, I know there's expansions that take care of this and stuff, but I don't care for the game because the first couple of times I played it, the cards that I drew and the cards that everyone was drawing from, they have certain abilities and everybody draws from sort of the same cards. You put together these chains of abilities that do X. And if you do enough of X, you win. And none of the cards that were available to us in any way involved anyone else on the board. And so it would be my turn, shuffle card, shuffle card, shuffle card, shuffle card, done. Next person, next person, next person, next person, my turn. Shuffle card, shuffle card, shuffle cards, and they're done. I could play the entire game looking down at my hand, never making eye contact with another person, and it's just like shuffle, 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 shuffle. Somebody lays a card down and go, win! And it's just like, well, okay, great. Congratulations. Can we play a real game now?
I'll throw that back to you and say, that's you as a role player. In a role-playing game, it's not possible for the players to sit around the table, play the game, and still have a casual conversation like, oh, how are your parents doing? How are the kids doing? Mm-hmm. What happened at work today? In a game like Choo-choos and Crayons, you can have a compelling game where you're each matching your ability to plan over mm-hmm. the other players. And because there's not this in-game mechanic of punching each other in the face, you can have a conversation about work while you're mm-hmm. playing it. And that's why if you're a new gamer, don't ignore these games, because that's one of the ways you'll sell gaming to your friends who don't play, mm-hmm. because they can say, we're going to get together, play a game, but it won't command my attention for all 3 hours,
yeah,
where I can go, I'm going to still talk to the people who I love to share the company of and play a game, which is one of the reasons I like it, because I like games because you sit around a table and talk with people.
Sure, sure.
I also like testing my puzzle solving ability, which is why I tend to be a gaming gourmand. I'm all over the place.
Yeah.
One of the things that I want to plug here is I think it's awesome is something that's put out by the guys over at Pulp Gamer. This is actually something I have referenced lately. They have a thing they're doing with Mayfair called the White Glove Series. And you can find this on Mayfair's site, where what they do is they do these little video demos where they take a white glove and they kind of, you know, green screen or whatever out the rest of the image. Mm-hmm. So you kind of get this disembodied glove, and they narrate how to play the game, and they show you a quick little 5 or 10 minute sample of how the game would play.
Yeah, they'll show you the unboxing of the game beforehand. Yeah. So you see, here's what it comes in when
exactly.
You open the box.
So you get a sense just from looking at these of here's what it would be like to play a typical game. Here's how many pieces it's going to involve. Mm-hmm. Here's what setup looks like. Here's how gameplay goes. And you can pretty quickly understand, hey, this is something that my friends or my family would really enjoy versus, okay, this isn't really what I expected. I think those are great.
That's really cool.
And quite frankly, I wish, and I say this not just as a friend of Don's, but I just say this as a consumer, I wish more game companies would contract them to do those. Because
if I'm going to buy a game sight unseen where I've never played it, but I think that I'll really like it, I always go on Board Game Geek and I look at the pictures. They have picture galleries for every game there that is the contents of the box. And not only contents of the box, but people playing the game, so that you kind of get a sense of that. That White Glove series that you're talking about is awesome.
And there's one thing to keep in mind when you're looking at those pictures, that might not be what your actual characters look like.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of
very good painters that are on Board Game Geeks. So if you're looking at a game that has the actual game comes with a little plastic figure that has no color, they've probably painted that in almost every picture you're going to see.
And also,
it's a wonderful paint job that won't be in the box.
And also, the hot chick with the plunging neckline does not come with any of these games.
Many of the Board Game Geek game pages have video links. There's a lot of individual gamers out there just doing, I'm going to produce this amateur video of here's how to play the game. There was a wonderful podcast called Board Games with Scott Nicholson. It's ended just recently as the guy has changed how he wants to approach it. But he has a series that's still available on iTunes of probably like 100 games of here's the unboxing. Here's how to play it. Here's the turn structure, things like that. You can find those resources on iTunes, or more likely Board Game Geek has links to them. Mm-hmm. And absolutely, as someone who just bought a game, and you're looking to introduce it to your friends, a video explanation of that is very helpful as Mayfair is learning.
Yeah, that's true. I learned how to play diplomacy off of YouTube.
Yep.
That's how I learned to play diplomacy was YouTube.
Their main diplomacy how-to videos were great.
Yeah, they were. They helped quite a bit because I had never played the game prior to that one time. And yeah, I learned off of YouTube. What I want to wrap this up with, we can go around the table here a little bit, though. I think Jeff's going to probably have the preponderance of stuff. Which is, I want to skip past what are the common favorite picks, because you can get these off Board Game Geek, or you've probably at least heard the names either on this podcast or at a convention or whatever. And I want to move past that to instead, if you are relatively new to this hobby or only dabble in it, what are some titles out there that you may not heard of, but at least someone at this table thinks you should have? And I'm going to go first, and I'm going to throw out a game called Suro, spelled T-S-U-R-O.
Everybody sitting here is like, he just took mine!
Yeah. And what the game is about is you get tiles, and you have these little stones that have dragons on them, and you place them on hash marks around a gridded board, and when you put down a tile, there is a path that directs your dragon stone to go a certain direction. And eventually your tiles will hit other people's tiles, and either, if you're lucky, loop you around and keep you on the board, or if you're not so lucky, create a path that your dragon follows off the board and dies. And I love this game because it is simple to set up. It only takes about 15 minutes to play, and it is the sort of game that, quite frankly, I think anyone from about ages 5 or 6 and up can get.
Some of the great things about it.
It's a beautiful game.
Oh, the production value.
It's a beautiful game.
Wonderful.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. Just as much fun with 2 people as it is with 6, and the gameplay experience is different with 2 versus 6.
Well, and it actually doesn't stop at 6. I believe it's 2 to 8 is the player range.
Yeah, it's one of the few games that goes to 8 players that doesn't take 4 hours at that level.
Yeah.
And it's so easy to understand such a simple concept. You can set it down in front of anyone, whether they're a board game person or not, and they get it.
All right, so since Jeff could probably quickly stuff everyone here. I'm going to go to the right instead. Chad, you got one?
That I would introduce somebody to? I would actually say Battlestar Galactica. And I think that a lot of people would be like, well, wait, you can't introduce a new person to that. It's got too much stuff, too many rules. If you are an experienced board gamer and you are introducing a new person to it, you're taking them under your wing and teaching them how to play, I think it is an excellent game. It's a social game. It is a game that is just as fun to lose epically as it is to win courageously. It's got interesting mechanics to it. The production values are great. It's got a science fiction theme. You don't have to have ever have watched the show to get it, to get what's going on. It's simple to pick up, simple to learn once you kind of get what's going on. Once that light goes off in your head, it's like, oh, I get it. I get what's going on. And it's a very social game. It is very, very so. It's all about interaction and talking to people.
And lying.
And lying. It has a lot of lying in it because it has a traitor mechanic. And I think that would really help new gamers, because instead of a game like My Dominion Experience, if My Dominion Experience, which I know is not typical, was my first game, there's no social aspect whatsoever. You know, if there's no talking and stuff, the game actually makes people talk and they make people kind of do a back and forth. And it really gets people emotional about the game, too, because there's a traitor mechanic and a sense of paranoia. It's just all around good fun.
Yeah, you guys have both so far taken two games that are on my top five to introduce people to. I mean, those are both great games.
Good. That means you got three more.
Yep. I'm going with basically a gateway game. I've mentioned a couple times in this episode, Return to Castle Ravenloft, the board game. Because if you have a group of role players that you want to get into board games, here's an easy introduction over. If you have a group of board gamers you want to introduce role-playing concepts to, this is pretty close to what I understand to be 4E. You bring this out, you get them started, you get ready to make the next jump. It's a game that can be played with one people through five people, I believe.
You know,
I can play it by myself, I can play with other people.
I guess that is somewhat of a fascinating difference. If we look at the game shopping habits here, with Chad and Wayne, they're primarily focused on finding a game they can sell to role players. I'm typically trying to find games I can sell to my family so we can stop freaking playing apples to apples.
Yeah, and I look for games that I can play by myself or that I can play with my wife. I want to have a great game experience if I'm by myself, if I just have my wife, or if I'm bringing the game to play with you guys. Right. So for me, to get my money, especially if it's a game of that expense, because it's not a cheap game, it's going to have to be a game that I can that mixes with all that. And I'm a fan of what's known as Ameritrash games. I love lots of little tactical pieces. And this game meets that need, too.
I want a game that fills up an entire table.
I want a game that seats a lot
of people. This meets that, too.
I want a game that seats a lot of people, has some flexibility, but isn't so complex that it's going to frighten non-gamers.
If I were to kind of rewind back to Might, and if I were to take another turn real quick, because Pat's about to talk, he hasn't said anything all episode, so I have to stop that.
So go ahead and keep talking over.
If you wanted a game that not too many people have heard of, Jeff, correct me if I get the name wrong, I think it's called Power Boats. It's a game where there's tiles. There's these squares, and the squares are mainly water, but they have little islands on them, and you put them together, and there's a bunch of them, so you can have a sort of different course each time. Pieces are these little plastic motor. Oh, please tell me you've heard of this game. Did I stump the savant?
You may have.
This sounds like Duck, Duck, and Go.
So Mississippi Queen?
No. Your tokens are the piece you're doing are little 3D plastic models of power boats, and it's a power boat race. You all started at the start line. When it's your turn to go, you roll a die. And that's how many squares you will move. So you have to point yourself first which direction you're going and then roll. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to, there's buoys. And so you just don't go in a straight line. You have to go all the way around this course in this really weird pattern all over the place. And if you run into another boat or you run into an island, you dead stop. And you have to arrange yourself again and roll and try and get around. So it's really difficult to make turns and stuff. So you have to kind of plan out. And it's a risk reward thing. It's just like, well, I don't know. I really enjoy it. I think it's a good game to kind of introduce people into.
Pat?
actually Settlers of Catan, and I approach it more like from the way you do it, Dan, and the fact that I have my role-playing group, which I can play role-playing games and on the occasional board game, but I also have my other subset of friends that are not role players at all.
You have other friends who aren't us?
Six. and, you know, they don't do role playing games at all, but they do like to play games. And we'll play a lot of card games, like a lot of, you know, Rummy. Liverpool Rummy is actually one of our favorite games to play. But I'd kind of like to branch that out into something else. And I think, you know, Settlers, I think, is a good one because it's not really role playing. It's not even associated with like fantasy role playing or anything like that, or even Battlestar Galactica. Mm-hmm. But it's just sort of a, you know, it's a way that you can introduce something new. So those are the kind of games that I like because, and again, for me, it gives me the ability to have a wider selection of people to play it with because I could play it with you guys or I could play it with them too. So that's what I look for.
All right. I'm going to try and take on every person here with at least a game that matches, if not captures more effectively.
I feel what I they're won talking about. The
You're
game
going of, to one up each one of us.
I'm
going to
try.
Let's go. I feel I already won this podcast because I stumped Jeff on a game.
You did indeed. However, I know the game that game is based on.
Ooh.
And that's where I'm going to trump you.
Yeah, well, I played the Buffy the Vampire Slayer board game at a meetup once.
I own Trump the board game. Okay. First, for the game you can sit down to a group
of people.
And this
is for Dan?
This is for Dan.
Okay.
The game you can sit down, you can be playing in the matter of 5 minutes or less, and it's language neutral, so you can have... I've taught 9-year-olds this game, and they've played competitively with 30-year-olds. Blockus.
Blockus is a fun game.
It is a simple game where you have plastic pieces of basically 1 to 5 squares, and they're of all possible configurations.
They look like Tetris pieces.
They look like Tetris pieces. You're trying to get them all onto the board. The hitch is you can get as close as you want to other players' pieces, but you can only touch your own on corners. It's a geometric exercise, but it's non-language oriented. 9-year-olds can see how shapes work against each other. Usually they bump into 1 or 2 times where, you know, like, no, that bunch that edge is there. They get it after that. So if I'm sitting down with a group of people who haven't played and I don't think they're really, really into the experience of it at all, I'll bring Blockus out when I've actually probably sold at least 2 copies of it.
You've sold a copy to me. Yep. I went out and bought it afterwards.
And went to visit some friends in Bay City, Michigan. And the gamer's a diehard Amber role player, played forever and ever. But his parents didn't really play games. They bought Blockus. And I rank that as an achievement.
Yeah.
Now, for co-op games, which is part one for you, against my better judgment, I'll get into this in a second, I'm going to recommend Pandemic.
I love Pandemic.
Pandemic is very good for the main reason that there's no traitor mechanic, which, to bridge back to what does that term mean, it means one or more players in the game are secretly the member of the other team.
I love traitor mechanics.
But actually, though, isn't there a pseudo traitor mechanic expansion?
It's an absolute traitor mechanic.
Yeah, in the expansion they came out with,
nobody plays it because there's too much paperwork involved.
Yeah, well, the game's too hard as it is.
And the difference is you know who the traitor is then.
Well, right. I said that's why it's not exactly a traitor mechanic because he's not betraying you. He's an enemy.
Yeah.
And I'll bridge off for a second there to say another mechanic you might see described is hidden movement, which the bioterrorist uses, which is the board is all public, but one player is writing down their movements in secret on a notepad, and the other players have to deduce where they're going, which is how the bioterrorist mechanic works. There's a game called Dracula's Fury, where there's the Dracula hunters, and Dracula has to like write down where he's going. He plays cards.
Lots of trains and stuff.
He gets busted, stuff like that. But Pandemic is good because all the players can openly discuss what's going on. If there's one player who knows the game more than everyone else, he can absolutely explain what the good idea is. That, to me, boiled down to be the problem later, which is even if you don't want to, you can turn this into one player and three puppets.
Yes.
It's a very fine art. And the other problem I had with it was that after a while, it turned into a board meeting.
Yeah. I love Pandemic. I own it. I've played it a lot. I've played the expansion. I enjoy playing it with people who are equal to my skill level. And my skill level is not that good because I have done that. I have played it with people who are the pro gamers, so to speak, and they're cool, nice people. Again, they're not slitting my throat here. They're just really, really good at it. And we played 1 round, 2 rounds, 3 rounds, and then they sat down and said, wait, stop. And they got a piece of paper. It's like, okay, You do this. They made a workflow for the game. And I'm like, do we have a project manager? Do we have to get sign off from a director from this? It's just like, holy crap.
And I bet you still didn't win that
game. No, we did win because we had a workflow and it was a project and the whole thing went like clock. It was a Swiss clock.
Vizio said you could win.
Yes.
I know people who have won. I've never won that game.
I've won a few times. I absolutely recommend players play Pandemic with new gamers because it lets everyone walk through on the same page. Mm-hmm. Once you've got them there, I sold mine. That's, you know, what I'm going to say. Now, for the other one you brought up, Powerboats, the game that this is directly related to is an ancestor to is a car racing game called Formula Day. And it's actually written as Formula D, but you go German, it's a day.
I really wanted to play this game. It looks awesome.
You have a car, you're racing around a track, you have a gear shift, which is, for most gamers, a D4, D6, a D8, a D10, and they're weighted. They're not, like, you know, all the numbers. So, for instance, the D20 has, like, the numbers between, like, 11 and 20 repeated in some variation. And during your return, your character to choose whether downshift or upshift. And when you hit turns, if you plow through the whole turn without being able to stop, your car takes damage based on braking and hitting the side of the wall and stuff like that. So it's very much, how much faster do I want to go? Am I willing to damage my car in turn for gaining advantage? Which is some of what the Powerboat's description you gave is. So Formula Day should be readily available. Has, like, I don't know if
I think they just reprinted it.
They may have just reprinted it, and I don't know if they're all available, but plenty of different game boards with things like this. Now, for the game that role players and people familiar with...
I'm hoping you one-up me with HeroQuest.
No. The game that people who have followed fantasy sci-fi IP properties would be able to get into. My nominee here is Star Wars The Queen's Gambit.
Never even heard of it.
It is a two-player game that can be played as a four-player game if you just play teams. It's light side versus dark. The dark side controls the droids, and the light side player controls the Naboo troopers plus Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon, and the dark side player controls Darth Maul. I have played this game and come to a better appreciation of Episode 1. Two reasons. Jar Jar isn't in it. Gungans are in it, but they aren't. And second of all, illustrates the sensitivity of the Queen's plan, which was the feint on the battlefield with Gungans versus droids versus the real meat of it, which was to get Naboo troopers up to the third level of the palace to basically get the Viceroy out of the way. I've always seen this game come down to a close match, and the game is played on three different maps at the same time. You've got the battlefield map. You've got this really cool build at three levels 3D palace map. Hmm. And then you've got Anakin sailing around dodging asteroids and trying to blow up the droid control ship.
But you don't have single player, so I think I still win.
You don't have single player, that is correct. But I went with what game will grab people who are, you know, fans of the larger sci-fi fantasy settings.
Pat knows a single player game.
And then for kind of the classic game, like Catan, which has been around since 1995 and certainly has its roots tried and tested, I think I'm actually going to go with a game I mentioned earlier, Carcassonne. The problem with Catan is that if you've got someone who's in the lead, every other player, generally speaking, starts punching them in the face. They won't get to trade. They will constantly put the robber on them, that kind of thing, which can, especially if you're learning games, lead to some hard feelings. Carcassonne is a lot more, not cooperative, but polite. You know, you've got your road, you're working on your road, you've got your city. And so I think, and it's also got like 12 expansions. Settlers of Catan has more than, but two or three different expansions, all of which, except for the 5-6 player, I don't recommend, by the way. I think, you know, by the way, any game companies that are listening to this, if you're going to consider expanding your board game, make a different game instead. Because usually the reason you're trying
expansions.
To usually the reason you're expanding the game is because the game has a significant following because it's popular, which means the mechanics are good on their own. I own Battlestar Galactica. I love the game. There's also an earlier version of it basically called Shadows Over Camelot, which is also cooperative with the trader mechanic. I'd recommend that as well. They came out with an expansion called Pegasus based on some of the later events in the show. It just adds a little too much. It's certainly too much for one group to really walk in and absorb in one night. And they're coming out with another expansion.
It's out.
It's out now. Exodus. And the same problem has been experienced with Arkham Horror. Arkham Horror has enough expansions out where you're going to need a 2-foot by 2-foot cubic volume to carry it around. But the main game is fine.
Arkham Horror I like some of the aspects of the expansions. I like the ones that don't add a board. I want new characters to play, new stuff to get, new spells to have, and new monsters to fight.
Yeah, I think another great reason to have an expansion is adding players. Yeah, the expansions for Catan are really key if you have a larger group, just to add more players.
Which is absolutely the reason I'd recommend getting expansions for Race of the Galaxy, because they add players. That's the core reason, in my opinion, to expand the game. But then again, in my opinion, you should have designed the game there in the first place, especially if you knew it was coming.
Yeah, I agree. I would have been happier if Catan just came off the shelf handling six players instead of needing an expansion.
And so if I'm looking for a game that's kind of the classic that you can walk people through, that later they can go off on their own, go to a board game meeting and go, I recognize that game. Catan is good, but I think Carcassonne is just a little bit friendlier.
You know, I like Carcassonne. I really enjoy it. I've never played the board game version. I've only played it on PC. I have no idea how you actually score the game.
It's fine until you get to farms, in which case you need a team of MIT.
And then there's three or four different ways to score
farming. That's the problem. They actually reprinted it and edited the farm scoring rules. So actually,
US, European, tournament
setting. Yeah.
It is an incredible game with using electronic tools to do the math for you.
Yeah.
I wish there were more games like that where you can move the math off onto something else.
The roads, the castles, the monasteries, they're all fine. It's just the damn farms.
Actually, not just scoring the farms. Usually what the computer game simulates or handles best is whether or not it's legal to put your follower into the farm.
In the first place.
In Carcassonne, if someone controls a feature like a city or road, you can't put your guy in there. You have to like put your guy on a separate road, then try and link it up later, which is sniping, which I am like way known for in my own Illinois circle for Carcassonne. In the computer implementation, it just goes, you can't go there. It doesn't even give you the dot to say you can place your guy there because it knows. And that's the reason I'd recommend computer and video game versions of board games, not just for the fact that you don't have to set it up and cart it around, not just for the fact that you can play online with friends who are in different locations, but because it is a solid way to learn the mechanics. For instance, Dominion, mentioned before. If you get all the expansions, there's literally probably like 150 cards in there. All of them have different texts, different effects, different costs. People who don't play Dominion very much, you hand out a set of 10 cards for them to play with during the game. They have to read every one over and over again. There is a good website online. I believe it's dominion.isotropic.org, but I don't know. I'll try and get that information later. But over the last month, evenings, weekends, I've probably played 150 games of Dominion. Two players or three players, even four players. I know those cards like the back of my hand now. And so I can bring that to a face-to-face group and go, I don't have to screw around with what cards are there. I know what's there. And this is the same for, I've seen a computer implementation of St. Petersburg, which is a lovely game for, you know, 2 to 4 players simulating Russia, where there's a computer implementation out of it, and you can just play the heck out of it and learn it without bothering everyone else and wasting 4 hours playing a single game. Because right now, Dominion, if you play it face-to-face, going to take about an hour and a half. If you play it on the computer, because it handles all the transactions, all the shuffling, everything like that, 15 minutes, you're done.
Yeah.
And the game I'll bring up, generally speaking, for what game do I think not a lot of people know about that they should, if you're interested in board gaming, is Le Havre. And that's H-A-V-R-E. It's the game of a French port where your company is buying and selling goods, building buildings on the port like that. I think it's one of the best of the new crop of highly strategic games where there's a lot of stuff to digest. It's by a great designer, Uwe Rosenberg, who's done a lot of good games, Agricola, if you've heard of it, things like that. But
it ties together a lot of mechanics. I really like it.
It ties a lot of mechanics. So once you learn Le Havre, you'll have a good shot at going out at learning other games which use some of those mechanics in different ways. And once everyone at the table knows it, it plays fairly quickly. Whereas if you play Agricola, I really honestly think if you have a 5 players who've played it 10 times, it still takes 3.5 hours. So Le Havre is a next generation game. It uses basically the latest thinking on how to use these various systems of resource management organization. It is something that almost any board gamer who's playing a lot of games these days will know and be able to go, I've played that game, let me help you. It plays solitaire.
Yep.
And it is a little on the expensive side. It's about $65, I believe, but you're getting great value for it. Those would be the games I would bring up as games that certainly not many people on the Parker Brothers Hasbro circuit knows about. They're certainly worth looking into.
I'm happy to say I've played every game everyone brought up here except for
Powerboats, motorboats.
I think you made that up.
I have played it multiple times. I do not own it. I'm sure that there's. I'm sure it's called like Super Boat Race or something. And somebody out there's like, Dave's saying it wrong. He keeps saying it wrong.
Well, I know we've thrown out a lot of titles, and so what I might try to do is, as I go back and post the show notes for this, if time allows, we'll try and get these listed out in the show notes so someone in the car or at work can look them up at their leisure, and maybe where I can also provide some links to, I don't know, whatever relevant sites I can find
for every single games. One of these games is going to be listed in detail ad nauseum on Board Game Geek.
So I'll find resource. Some way to, if I can, and time allows, once again, to link some of these things back so you guys can find all these. But either way, I hope this was a somewhat informative or interesting episode. And Jeff, I want to thank you for joining us and bringing this insight.
Utterly my pleasure.
And everyone, be sure to check out his podcast at
MySpace.com. Go to iTunes. It's there.
We will post a real link to his show. So thank you guys very much for tuning in, and we will catch you next week.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2011. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.